Well, I think we'll go ahead and get started. Looks like it's 1:30. And I want to go ahead and get started. I got plenty to talk to you about today and have plenty of time for questions, too. I entitled the session Women and the Origins of the Churches of Christ because I thought saying something like women in the split didn't really sound so positive, right?
But it's more descriptive.
Yes, it may very well be. But that's essentially what I'm going to be talking about at the time when there was a lot of division in the church. You know, where did women fit in to that picture? And to tell you a little bit about myself, I'll tell you about myself in a second. Let me start with the goals of what I'm going to do today. Two main things. I want to explore the impact of female leadership in Stonehill women, particularly this era, about 1870 to 1906, give or take a few years. I'm going to be moving with a concept of women as bridge leaders, and I'll explain to you what that means, kind of to describe their role during that era. Then, secondly, in a related sense, I'm going to be looking at the central role of gender and the key issues that define the origins of the churches of Christ, particularly in Tennessee, though I would say it probably translates to most other places as well. But since Tennessee is kind of a key, I don't know, battleground, maybe that's a negative word to use, but was kind of that way, then I chose to focus on Tennessee because some key things happened there. And particularly, you could even say almost Nashville, although there'll be a few other cities that get involved too, but... And, of course, here I've listed the two key issues we'll look at. It'll be the two big ones, the instrumental music and missionary societies. And many people are unaware that those were all about gender, especially the instrumental music one. You can kind of make the case that gender was all wrapped up in it. The role of women, ideas about women, women themselves, is even wrapped up in that issue. More people are aware that missionary societies were more about gender. But, that's the goals for today. But I thought I'd mention a little bit about how I came to this project. And I guess the first part of the story is that I what's maybe different about me than a lot of other presenters at this conference is I'm just a straight-up historian, not a church historian, or I don't have any kind of theological degree or anything. I started out as a history major here at Pepperdine. In fact, my mentor is here, Dave Fick. He was the one who said to me when I was working on a big project, said, you should do something about women. And at the time, I thought of that. This is in like the early 90s. I thought, I don't know if I'm kind of radical enough to do that. You know, I associated it with all kinds of crazy ideas. I learned, it's a wide open field. There's so much going on to study about women. And I'm going to graduate school. And the real turning point is I needed a dissertation topic. And by then, I knew almost nothing about Churches of Christ before I came to Pepperdine. I had grown up in the Christian churches / Churches of Christ. But even then, it was mostly in Utah where I wasn't really aware of the broader history of the movement in any way because of the particular context there. So I'm learning about all this, and I thought, wow, what's going on with women in that context? I was drawn to looking at how do women of faith see their way? How do they live their lives? I was pretty sure they probably valued their faith as I valued mine, and I wanted to see what that looked like in historical eras. So I thought, how am I going to do this? How am I going to look at women in this movement? What's going to be the dissertation topic? What I ended up stumbling into after a little bit of effort was this woman. So you can see, I had a different name even then, so it'd be a long time ago that I researched and wrote about her. Selina Campbell, second wife of the Campbell part of the Stone Campbell movement that we call our movement nowadays. And turns out there was an extensive archive collections of her papers that were still in existence, and so I could pretty well reconstruct her life quite a bit. Basically used her as a window both into the Stone Campbell movement and what women were thinking and doing, as well as just women in the 19th century in general, because she lived from 1802 to 1897. It was a good, fun project because I went to a Jesuit institution, Georgetown in D.C., and they knew nothing about the Stone Campbell movement. I educated the whole faculty about it. So I kind of enjoyed that, actually. And they were thrilled to have me because the PhD program attracts more secular students, so they don't generally have students of faith. So having a student of faith, they were thrilled to pieces I was there. So it was a good relationship. I think turning point came after the publication of this. One of the editors in the series referred me to this group, was looking for someone to write about women in that tradition for this encyclopedia. So I went from just this biography that I've done of one woman to, let's do about 30 pages on the whole movement. That was my first kind of dipping my toe in the water. I was really interested in it, excited to do the project, did that. I look back on it now, but man, I knew nothing then compared to now. But it was kind of my first foray. Realized I really liked this, and so increasingly I was interested. I guess I didn't put this on the slide, and I should have. I kind of skipped this step. Major turning point came when I was invited to work on the global history that came out a couple of years ago as one of the 14 authors. Although I got the hard job, they had me writing on women outside the U.S. and non-white women. That was rough, because finding information and such. But it really inspired me that, oh my, the things I did find made me realize, wow, there's a lot of things that we need to tell. And a lot of it went into that book, but even since then, I finally committed to, right not long after we finished the global history, I got a sabbatical and decided, okay, it's time. I'm going to do the global history of women in STEM camp women. And so that's what I do now in all my spare time, which isn't much since I have 3 children, age 9 and under, but it's coming along. So you're going to see a segment of that project today. Another turning point for me was this book when I read it, The Next Christendom, Coming Global Christianity. It's kind of a well-known concept now. For whatever random reason, I think I read this book. There was a book club here at Pepperdine. I think I did it because I was pregnant with my first child and realized my life was about to not have time to read anymore. I'll join this. It's my last chance to do something intellectual before. And my life was changed by this book. This book discusses the fact that the growth of Christianity right now is in the global south, they call it. South America, Africa, southern parts of Asia. This is where the real energy of Christianity is kind of dying in the rest of the world, in a sense. And that made me also think about, where do women fit in that process, and women in our movement. It made me realize if I'm going to write a global history, it needs to be a lot about women in those parts of the world, which is challenging to do, and I will definitely do it imperfectly as part of it. So I just wanted to come clean about that focus of the study, though today I won't focus on that quite as much. I'm going to tell you this particular story that I've been developing most recently. This is where I'm kind of thinking about, kind of moving through a few different issues in the movement. This is where I am now at this one. And to tell you about women during this kind of post-Civil War era, I want to start with a concept I'm kind of using to try to understand the role that women have in the history of the movement. This looks to be, so far, the kind of main theme of the book that I'm writing, which is this idea that female leadership was key to the development of the Stonecamp movement in a wide variety of ways, but it's not the same as male leadership. It doesn't look the same. And so I've been working on defining it. Well, what is it then? What did it look like? So I borrowed a concept that I read somewhere else. It dawned on me one day, I had this aha moment. Oh, wait a minute, this sounds like this other book that I read. So I found my model for female leadership, of bridge leadership, and I'll define that term for you in a little bit. From this woman's book, Belinda Brognette, How Long, African-American Women in Struggle for Civil Rights. It's a book about women's role in the Black Civil Rights Movement. I read this book. I have my students read it a lot when I'm teaching various classes. Excellent book that describes the central role of women in the Black Civil Rights Movement. But outside of Rosa Parks, most people cannot name a single woman ever connected to, and yet they were critical to the success of the Black Civil Rights Movement in a variety of ways. So I thought, what she says about that is kind of the same about what happened in the Stonecamp movement. And so I've been borrowing a lot of what she says about that to help us understand what role women did play. So the term bridge leadership was first applied to women in the civil rights movement. But if you want to know what it is, it can also be termed a grassroots leader. That's kind of a synonym. Sort of leading from below rather than from above. So not a top-down, but a bottom-up. She also described it as kind of behind the scenes or private. It kind of operates outside of structures and hierarchies. And, of course, most bridge leaders, but not all, certainly, are women. Men can be, too, just as well. It just doesn't have to be this way. But you see, most tend to be women. But, of course, as she says about the Black Civil Rights Movement, they played this key role in building and sustaining the movement. I mean, she uses examples like it was women in the grassroots areas, like local precincts, that would round up their neighbors to go to a civil rights protest, convince them, because the neighbors would be responding like, you can get killed doing that, you can go to jail, we're not really interested. And these women would convince them, we must, for a variety of reasons. You can just imagine how that would work. So they're the ones at the bottom level, really And you know, you don't have a Black civil rights movement without the turnout of the protests and all that. So these, it was women that convinced people to do this. And so I'm going to make an analogy. Some similar things happened in the Stone Campbell movement. Now, just to be clear, you know, then how does bridge leadership differ from what we might call traditional leadership? Now, I came up with a little chart to explain to people where I'm going with this more visually. And left column is the bridge leaders and the traditional leadership. And I came up with some categories of differences that you can see. One is visibility, of course. Like I said, bridge leaders are more private behind the scenes, traditional leadership more public. With the gender mostly female versus mostly male. And then race is a key issue, too. It's much more difficult for people of color to be kind of in a traditional leadership role. And that's a whole other complicated thing, but I'll allude to it a little bit at the end of the presentation today. Now, the relationship to institutions is really key. Note this, bridge leaders, they're unpaid, they're untitled. I think it's funny, one of the things Churches of Christ do is get very creative with titles so that you can put women in different roles. You know. It's okay to call them a ministry leader, but, you know, not okay to call them a preacher or, you know, something like that. So titles matter, you know, in a sense. But anyway, so they're outside of institutions. You know, they're influential, but they're not in authority. So, of course, public leadership is more, or the traditional leadership, it's institutionalized. You're paid, you're elected, you're titled, and very authoritative. So I have examples here. Of course, preachers' wives, ministry leaders, mothers, Sunday school teachers. These are the kinds of people that would fit into this category. And then, of course, the kinds of people that would fit into traditional leadership. Now, okay. I thought I'd start here with what, and you can see if you disagree with me, but especially this era, I'm looking at the late 19th century, I thought some common perceptions of women's role in the origins of the Churches of Christ is that they were pretty silent, didn't have much to say, that they were uninvolved, that, you know, kind of passing by, they were passive in the process, and, you know, you might call them pew warmers, you know, they're just kind of there, they're not really having a voice, and that the issues at play in the origins of the Churches of Christ had nothing to do with women's interests. But I think, I'm hoping to convince you today that all of those are untrue in their own way. That the very issues that lead to the identity of the Churches of Christ had a lot to do with what women said and did and who they were. So let me explain. Okay. So I'll start a little bit with, okay, we're talking about origins of the Churches of Christ. There's a whole complex set of things that come into play. I think historians are still ironing this out a little bit. Read any different historian of the Stone Campbell movie, you'll get a slightly different take. But I borrowed a little bit from some who have made presentations on this, just to give you some overviews. Like, for instance, here's a simple chart of the kinds of division we're talking about. You start out with two separate movements come together, they're together for a while, and then there's two separate ones again. Some try to draw lines between the two. I don't know if you can that easily. There's a lot of issues at play going on. Then, if you compare these two main groups, and here are some of the issues, of course, that come up in how you define who these groups are. Everything from, here we have Missionary Society of Instrumental Music supported by the Disciples of Christ. Some call them a more liberal group. I guess that's one term you could use, a more progressive. Then, of course, in the Churches of Christ, a more kind of conservative group, you know, opposition to those things. And you get to other kind of key factors in how they saw things differently, such as, you know, the silence of the Bible allows for things, as long as it's not expressly forbidden. It's almost like those who interpret the Constitution, right? Maybe think about what your strict interpretation is, or you know, do you allow for, or kind of more the Hamiltonian view, where, hey, if it's not forbidden, you can do it. Or the Jeffersonian view, if it doesn't say you can do it, you can't do it. Same in between Disciples of Christ and Churches of Christ. And many historians have drawn attention to sociological factors. You know, that. In fact, I just heard a presentation on this. It was wonderful by Doug Foster at the Stone Campbell General Conference a month ago at Johnson University, where he talked about how, hey, 85% of the churches that stay with the Disciples of Christ are in the North, and 85% that stay with the Churches of Christ are in the South, roughly, you know, 85 to 90%, which tells you it's quite sectional in the division. And so most of these northern churches, they're urban, they're wealthy, whereas the Churches of Christ tend to be in rural communities, poorer in the South, and you get And then you have the other emphases. You know, unity is more important than restoration, or unity is more based on restoration. Just different conceptions. Now, some of these are kind of polar opposites, where there's a lot of gray area in between where people would fall. Now, you'll notice, you know, though not mentioned specifically, gender informs nearly all these issues and events. So I guess I'm setting it up all up for you, and then I'll explain where I see gender fitting in. Okay, I want to start with the missionary society one. This one's kind of easy. It's not hard to find gender here. There's a lot that goes on here. I'll start with some context, though. Very first missionary society ever in the Stone Temple movement was called the American Christian Missionary Society. It was organized in 1849, so yeah, we're still in the very early years of the movement. The idea was to develop some kind of mission strategy, mostly domestic in focus, although they did sponsor a few foreign missionaries, very few, to tell you the truth. In fact, in some ways, people, it's kind of an anomaly in the Stone Temple movement. It's kind of weird, but it never found a solid home, in a way. It was chronically underfunded, which was not true of other more missionary-minded faith traditions, if you make that comparison. They were much better funded. So, in a way, it was typical, and maybe that's because, I'll get to the second part, maybe partly it's an anomaly because there was definitely anti-institutional strain in the Stone Temple movement. When you think of both Barton Stone and Alexander Campbell, they didn't feel like they'd been treated very well by denominational structures. So they already had kind of an antipathy toward those. That was the whole identity of the movement. That those denominational structures cause problems, and missionary societies are part of a kind of denominational structure, so therefore they're always suspect. So that's why I think the American Christian Missionary Society always had an uneasy place in the Stone Campbell movement. Maybe that explains why it was so terribly underfunded. It really, in the first 3 decades, I think they maybe sponsored 3 or 4 missionaries, you know, which is not very many. And even those didn't get much funds, often had to raise their own money to fill in the gap. So while they are typical of organizations under religious traditions and their aims, they were always less funded, and I think that tells us a little bit about the identity of the movement. Things really take a different course, though, when you get to the Civil War. I think it was really hard for most Americans to be neutral. And you had quite a lot of Northern influence in the American Christian Missionary Society. And they began passing resolutions during the war supporting the North, which you can imagine after in a Southern church, deeply offensive to you. So now the Missionary Society gets very tainted by conflict over the Civil War, always wrapped up together. And so you have Southerners being much more likely to see these kind of institutions as oppressive. That in fact they have more political aims than they actually do spiritual or ecclesiastical ones. And if you take on that mindset, you're not going to want to support a missionary society. You're not going to have anything to do with it. And so, David Lipscomb, who I'll be focusing quite a bit on, many of you have probably heard his name, very key figure in Tennessee, held a lot of sway over churches in Tennessee and in other parts of the country as well. You know, published the Gospel Advocate, which is one of the most widely circulated newspapers of the era. He very vocally rejects missionary societies. But I almost feel like I should say, and now let me tell you kind of the rest of the story. Because you know, so far, it's still not much about women, right? But I did feel like there is a context, because I'm certainly not trying to say that women caused the whole thing. There is a context, but let me get to the specifics. Okay, so the real turning point in the debate about missionary societies is one that most people recognize this as a turning point. 1892 in Nashville. By the time you get to 1892, in addition to the American Christian Missionary Society, you've got one they call the Foreign Christian Missionary Society, which kind of assumed the mantle of taking on foreign missions. The American Christian one more domestically focused, getting to churches in different communities and states and such. However, one of the reasons you have the Foreign Christian Missionary Society is the men were getting horribly outfunded by the women who had founded their own in 1874, the Christian Women's Board of Missions. And women in most religious traditions had founded a missionary society, most Protestant traditions, even some non-Protestant. But the one in the Stone Camel was a little bit unique because it was one of the most independent and one of the most powerful. They out-fundraised on a sort of per capita basis most other traditions in North America. They were incredibly successful. And what was unusual about them as well, they owned all their own property, sent out all their own missionaries, trained them themselves. In fact, the eventual journal that would publish all the missions information about the movement was controlled and run by women. A lot of power they had. So in 1892, They hold a combined meeting of all three of these organizations, the Foreign Christian Missionary Society, American Christian Missionary Society, and the Christian Women of Florida Missions, in Nashville, which was really taking the fight to David Lipscomb, right in his backyard. A really aggressive move in a way, actually. I think Lipscomb did not appreciate that. But I think they were genuine. As far as how you interpret that, were they just being mean? I think partly they were trying to engage in a debate. Hey, let's talk about this. Let's, you know, all meet together, figure this out. But it definitely was a direct challenge to Lipscomb's influence, who had been doing everything he could to limit the influence of these organizations and had been fairly successful up to this point. Now, okay, now here, the rest of the story. Okay, so back to women now. What role do women play in that whole scenario, though? Where does that come up? And I start with the story of missionary, you know, how does female leadership connect to missionary societies? And it connects to their very origins. In fact, before you had the American Christian Missionary Society, you had women's groups. They were sometimes the first groups within individual congregations to form. Generally had a name either of the Ladies' Aid Society or a Ladies' Sewing Society. They were, from their origin, fundraising groups the typical model early on was women would get together and sew once a week, or maybe more often, depending. And they would either sew clothing for the orphans or the indigent in their neighborhood or in their church community. But other times, they would sew to sell the goods and make money, to do a wide variety of things, remodel the church, help build a new church, all kinds of things. So they're very common in the 19th century in really all Protestant traditions, well, and even all religious traditions in a way. Most churches have one. It was often the first organization in the church. And not unusually, women would form a ladies' sewing society, and it would grow into a church. That was not unusual either. They would raise enough money to build a building, and then get people gathering, and then hire a preacher. They funded church buildings, preacher salaries, local charities. One of the first of them was this one here, which formed sometime in the mid-1840s. It was definitely in place by 1849, probably about 1847. And here's one of the women who helped start it, Sophia Johnson. Many of you may be familiar with J.T. Johnson, who's a key figure in the Kentucky part of the movement early on, contemporary of Barton Stone, you know, and also a key figure in developing the College of the Bible, one of the key educational institutions of the Stonewall movement. Well, his wife, in her obituary, you read, she was not only an active member of the Female Sewing Society of the Georgetown Church for the benefit of female orphan school of Midway, but a subscriber of $100. So she helped them, which was a lot of money in 1940s. And so here, helping charitable efforts, you know, it's connected to the church. So you have women organizing themselves even before really the men get that organized, at least within the congregation. Now, this made women often the chief fundraiser of the church, not always, but very frequently. And so I found at least in the mid-1840s, you have at least two organizations. Who knows how many? The records are hard to come by. Sometimes the church burns, there go the records, you know, so it's hard to say how many there were. I found at least a couple. And so they predated the American Christian Missionary Society even. That's kind of the precursor. Well, what about the Tennessee Christian Missionary Society? This was a real turning point for Lipscomb. I think this is what really made him turn against missionary societies. I want to talk to you about this one a little bit. This is an organization that was right, again, in Lipscomb's backyard. It's kind of, often with the national groups, you also had state-level missionary societies that would essentially raise money to evangelize their own state. And that's what this organization was created to do. But how does it start? It actually starts by a group of women at a church in Nashville, the Woodland Street Christian Church, it was known. It started in a kind of ladies' aid society, ladies' sewing society. It gets various names. The women from the church called it the Women's Foreign Missionary Society, but it had other names as well. Some call it a sewing society. Well, many date this organization as the origins of division in the Tennessee churches. It was opposed by Lipscomb, you know, among others, in large part due to the public involvement of women, actually. But the formation of this organization really focuses the debate on Nashville, especially once you have that General Christian Missionary Convention coming to town, which is largely in support of that Tennessee organization. Here, we'll give them a boost. You know, they're doing good work. And after all these meetings, Lipscomb kind of gives up.
Did you accidentally sign?
And now, a little bit more about this. Here are the minutes that are eventually published that talks about how this organization was formed, which really becomes one of the most important organizations in Tennessee, especially if you're looking at the division of churches. And this is from their own, on the previous page I showed you. This is from the minutes that they published. Only one copy in existence that I know of. I managed to find it at the Christian Theological Seminary. They were kind enough to scan it and send it to me. I was very thrilled to find it. This is the first meeting they ever had. You can see it's at Chattanooga, Tennessee. And I can tell you a whole long story about this. It's a big drama about this. Just Google it sometime, the Tennessee Christian Missionary Society. You'll read that it gets involved in some court cases and stuff that I don't have time to go into today. It's really interesting. I want to focus mainly on these other parts. So this is probably a long section, but it really encapsulated their whole purpose and what they were doing, and I think it shows you also how women were central to the development of a missionary society in Tennessee. For quite a number of years, the thought of doing some missionary work in the destitute field of the state of Tennessee had been weighing on the minds of the ladies of the Woodland Street Church, but just how to do it was the question. So they're thinking about it, they're earnest prayer for years. April 1888, they have a ladies' foreign missionary society meeting at the church, and hey, let's create a home missionary fund. Each would put 25 cents into the fund, and then they could buy material from which they would make things, sell it, raise even more money. Okay, that was their plan. Look, I love this. No questionable methods, such as festivals, etc., have ever been resorted to. That was seen as a northern thing. It cracks me up, actually. Now my church has fundraisers for our youth group that are basically like a festival. Oh, you did this 100 years ago? Oh, bad news bears. But they saw that as kind of a northern thing, that create this spectacle of the church. For them, it was like the money changing in the temple. This is just not appropriate for what you should be doing at church. It should be very much about worship, not money making at church. So this guy's saying, no, this is your honest toil. We worked hard for this. We're not just, making a spectacle of the church. And then they list the women that were involved. I was thrilled to see their names. I had been looking, and finally, there are their names. Some of them were really prominent women. Sometimes I have fun Googling their names, see if I can figure out who they are. One of them, I'm trying to remember which one it was. Oh, this one. Mrs. J.W. Lindsay came from a family that had known Andrew Johnson. She herself had been to the White House during his presidency, so really prominent Tennessee family, some of these were. All right, so what do? They write letters to all the women in different churches in the state asking them to join the work. And they hired a man to go visit churches, raise even more money. And then they finally asked the elders of the Woodland Street Church, to take management. Of course, they got a lot of blowback, so they kind of had to get men to take it over. Because a lot of people were saying, oh, women can't be doing this. And anyway, then they hired this guy, Brother Muir. He's an interesting character, a Norwegian guy that ends up converting to Stone Campbell Movement. And he becomes their evangelist. Wandering through Tennessee, raising all kinds of money, founding a lot of churches, actually. If you start looking at the history of the movement in Tennessee, he founded a significant, dozens of churches, partly with the funding provided by these women that started the work. All right, so that's where this organization comes from. So we have men eventually take it over, but where was the energy? Where did it start? It was the women. It wasn't only in Nashville. Thought I would give you a sense of what these women did in their missionary societies and sewing society. Here's another one, the church in Johnson City. I was very disappointed. I was in the area recently. I thought, oh, I would love to go see some of these churches. A lot of them are no longer part of the movement. The buildings still exist, but now they're doing something else. But anyway, what about the First Christian Church in Johnson City? Their Ladies Aid Society, much work was done, such as sewing and quilting for the members. Both the money and the energy of the women went towards the beauty and adornment of the Lord's house. They painted the church inside, repaired the windows, made curtains for the baptistry, bought the first baptismal suit, bought and made the carpet, installed electric lights, donated to the pastor's salary monthly. I love this one. The communion wine made yearly by Mrs. Jane Miller's recipe is still famous today. In Australia, this is just random fact, I'll throw it in. Australia, they would have the grape stomping day. And they'd make the communion juice or whatever you want to call it for the year or whatever. And that's just an aside there. And that was women's job, by the way, to make that. And it would be a big festival for the women. They'd all get together. Makes me think of I Love Lucy or something, which is amazing. I can't even imagine what that day was like, or stomping all the grapes. fascinating stuff about what women were doing. So I guess to make a few observations, I mean, I'm still developing my own take on this. I guess what occurs to me after looking at, here's this most controversial organization. I didn't put it all in the PowerPoint. This is the one that Lipscomb's writing about all the time, the Gospel Advocate. And in the end, he goes to their convention, and he goes to that General Christian Missionary Convention. He's there. And what he writes in the Gospel Advocate, he's bothered by a number of things. What he goes on the longest about was these women making a spectacle themselves, speaking in public at these organizations. And to him, that was the final, like, death knell of the missionary society. I mean, he's already predisposed against it, but it was women speaking publicly that he was just done. And I thought, that's really important. You know, here, a lot of the, you know, origins of the Churches of Christ are about, wait, we don't want women doing A, B, and C. That was a big part of it.
We may say missionary society, but almost ends up being code for keep women doing less. For a variety of reasons. I don't have time to go into context stuff. Well, I want to get on to instrumental music, because this is the one you're probably thinking, well, how in the world did that have anything to do with women? I'll tell you, it's all about women, actually. Okay, here's the context. Some of my colleagues have pointed this out. For a long time, you had kind of a Puritan tradition of simple worship style that influenced the Stone Campbell movement. Keep worship simple. I think that's one of the strengths of the movement. I like it. And so, I also note, prior to the Civil War, almost all Protestant churches are a cappella. In fact, I have fun with people that I meet who are from other branches of the movement that have instrumental music. They'll say, oh, you're from the a cappella branch. I go, no, no, no. A cappella was what everybody was. You're from the instrumental part. Just to be historically accurate here. Now, part of this was connected to a real condemnation of Northern materialism. It was the Northern wealthy churches that were first to adopt instruments. And if you're the South, it feels like a really good thing to say those Northern wealthy churches see exploiting the world like they exploited the South and caused that war. Very connected to the lost cause. If you've studied American history, this is the idea that the South had to explain why it lost the war without losing face. So they say, well, we were the superior cause, but we got outmaneuvered by the military brute force of the North. But we're still the true superior culture. That's the lost cause rhetoric. Southern superiority. And that really comes through in the origins of the Churches of Christ as well. The North is going to do it, but we don't want anything to do with it. And in a more positive sense, that's kind of a negative way, a positive sense, to maintain a Southern identity. For many of them, it was, we keep our worship simple, we don't let missionary societies corrupt our churches, you know, that kind of thing. Now, okay, how does it connect to women? What does gender have to do with instrumentalism? And here it comes. Yeah. Ladies' aid societies buy a significant portion of organs in the late 19th century in the Stone Campbell movement, and most of the organists were women. And when you read some of these, it's like the women wanted an organ, so they bought it. Women were much more likely to support instrumental music than men. So, the interesting thing, though, that this connection between instrumental music and gender is also, it wasn't appropriate for women to play publicly. That's why I just excerpted this from the source I have that I scanned in, because I thought it was really fun. This is about the Frankfort Christian Church in Kentucky, one of the oldest churches in the movement. I mean, its origins go all the way back to the 18-teens. We had P.S. Fall there, Campbell was there a lot. I mean, it's really old church. And in the 1930s, someone writes a history of it, and there's a couple paragraphs that I excerpted here. At one point, they built this new church, and since the majority of the people were in favor of having instrumental music, Mrs. Hubman and Mrs. Landon Thomas, I'll have to tell you stories about them. They were wealthy philanthropists that bought a lot of things for the churches and helped build churches. Anyway, they went and got, you know, this new organ and presented it to the church. This was used for the first time during Mr. Moore's protracted meeting. Miss Emma Coleman, the organist, had the unusual experience of playing her own invitation hymn as she joined the church for the revival. Something to be fun, right? Okay. About 1880, this organ was replaced by a pipe organ, which was given by the AIDS Society. So here you go. You got the AIDS Society giving the pipe organ. And then what happens? Well, and now arose a delicate question. Hitherto, all the pipe organs in town have been played by men. And it was feared that it might seem rather bold for a lady to be seen commanding such a massive instrument. The matter was finally settled by putting a low curtain in front of the organ so that when a hymn was to be played, the pink-cheeked young organist could retire in proper seclusion behind the little purdah. Which, you know, is a reference to how Indian women lived, you know, behind closed doors where they could have no interaction with men outside of them. I thought that was a really clever way that they talked about it. A little bit of precedent for the woman playing the organ there. All right. So, in other words, women's voices were central to the instrumental music debate. when I finally figured that out, after I just kept reading, and I should tell you how I got to this. I'm reading a whole bunch of church histories. Because how do I find out what women did in churches? Well, I just start reading congregational histories, because sometimes it comes out. You know, somebody will say, oh, it's so good, this. And that's where I got this, for instance. And finally, I realized a pattern. Ooh, a lot of AIDS societies, because ladies' AIDS societies, are buying the organs. Women are playing, and then the church splits. So, again, that idea we have that women had nothing to do with instrumental music and missionary societies, and they were just on the sidelines, didn't participate at all. And I could literally, almost every issue and doctrine in the church's history, I could give you where women were right with it. I'm thinking, I'll give you one that is one of my favorites. Barton Stone, early on in his career, you remember he was a Presbyterian, they just did the infant sprinkling, right? Well, one day, a woman comes to him and says, I want to be baptized as an adult. I want to be immersed. And he says, well, I don't know about that. And then she pushes, and he finally does it, the first time he ever baptized someone. The woman said, you have to do this. And then from then on, he was all about adult baptism. And I can give you a bunch of incidences where key things that were defining characteristics of the Stone family women. It was women I don't even know that woman's name. I don't even know if it is recorded. It's in Barton Stone's autobiography. I don't even know if he said the name. Just said like a lady member or whatever. There you go. I can't remember. I'll have to look and see if her name is. But a lot of times we don't even know their names. And yet, you know, they do these significant things. Now, a few other things. I don't want to leave the impression that it's only about white women, though. But I have a problem, honestly. If you're talking about women of color, I meant to say women of color. I don't know why the and got in there. Sorry about that. Women of color. Sources are the biggest challenge, especially for the era I'm looking at, late 19th century, especially for women in the congregations that are becoming churches of Christ that are emerging from the other part of the movement. There's not many that say anything about what black women do. I mean, partly that's because, remember, a lot of them are Southern, so the black experience is not too central in the minds of white historians who are writing about these congregations. And many of the people would be, you know, not very wealthy, they're not going to leave behind a lot of records, so historians face big challenge. But there's other factors too. Look at this one. The Christian Echo is probably the key newspaper. That's where you get a lot of information about what's going on in the Stone Family Movement, right? It's all about the newspapers. Well, the key one for Black Churches of Christ, the Christian Echo, my understanding of what happens is that we don't have many issues of it before the 1930s, literally like a handful. I guess partly that's because the whole archive of it was in the back of G.P. Bowser's car when he was moving to Texas and he was in a car accident. I guess there was a project trying to recover them from various collections. I've seen only like, how many issues have I seen? Maybe 15 from, started in 1902, you know, until 1930 or whatever, and so there's 30 years of it. And I've maybe seen 15 or 20 issues, you know, a weekly paper, so not many have survived. Okay, other things though. If you're talking about women of color, and the stories. Slightly different for depending on different groups of women, but you're looking at kind of a triple bind. I got this from Edward Robinson's biography of Annie Tuggle. If you haven't read that, it's great. He points out that she really faced a triple bind. Her race, her gender, and her religion, being from a very conservative group that not a lot of people understood. But all of that has kind of contributed to the silence of women of color in our history. Very difficult to hear their voices. Get little glimpses every once in a while. Annie Tuggle's autobiography is astounding. It's a page-turner when you read it. So it's like practically the only source we have of so many things. But I did benefit from a presentation made by a man named David Meek in 1978 at the Fried Hardeman Lectures that was transcribed. Here's how he put it. I thought this was really important. The issues of music and society, you know, the themes I've been looking at, did not bother the black disciples in the backcountry away from Nashville. You know, so here we focus so much on Nashville, but there's more going on. There are three basic reasons why they did not. In the first place, blacks were not financially able to afford organs and pianos. Secondly, they could not play them. And thirdly, they were limited in their missionary work and travel. I thought still, I don't want to leave women of color out of the story altogether, so I'll say a little bit about Annie Tuggle and then leave time for questions. Annie Tuggle is a black woman who grew up in Tennessee. She would eventually play a key role in founding a number of churches, in raising money for educational institutions,
She became a teacher, taught at many of those institutions, so she's easily the most important black woman in the history of the Church of Christ.
And so I want to tell a little bit about her story, especially her involvement with the Silver Point Institute, one of the key educational institutions for blacks in the Church of Christ. First observation, blacks much more focused on education than missions. You can probably guess why. If you have almost no access to education, that becomes just the key issue. And so for them, I mean, not that they didn't care about missions. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying it was kind of a, got to get this done first. Education is the first thing for our survival, for our progress. So she eventually serves as a field agent for the Silver Point Institute, meaning she travels all over raising money for the school. So here, you know, here's this woman central to the development of black educational institutions in the Church of Christ. She also convinces Layton Lipscomb to support the school. Her autobiography is great about this. You know, she just went to see him. She tells the whole story of going to see him, convincing him to support the school. He recruits another man, a wealthy philanthropist in National Church of Christ, Henry Burton. I think he was an insurance man in that era, but he helps fund the school as well. Later on, I mean, she and her mother actually plan to leave their family farm to the school, but unfortunately doesn't make it. This was a very typical story. Runs out of money, has to close. I'll tell you one other interesting story, and then I'll take questions. But the other interesting story about Annie Tuttle is, she's working with G.P. Bowser, by the way. This was mainly his school. She works with him, if you're familiar with his name. He's a key figure in Black Churches of Christ as well. And they were founding another school in the Nashville area. It was called the Southern Practical Institute. It was only open 6 weeks. Here's why. They secure funding from Lipscomb and other generous white benefactors, but those generous white benefactors insisted they're going to have a school that all blacks and whites would enter by the back door, and only the white teachers go in the front. And he said, no way, not doing it. They closed. 6 weeks was all. Just to give you a sense of the challenges they faced. This is why maybe missions activity is not all the way up on your list when you're dealing with that. So, honestly, I don't know what role women really played in the debates in these black churches, because I think it gets trumped by other complicating factors, and we just don't have the records to know exactly in the same way. I didn't put it in here. There was another woman who worked, a black woman in the Disciples part of the movement, that was pivotal in organizing women's societies in black churches. So I can conjecture that there were plenty of women involved in the decision-making. That can't prove it yet. I'm still looking. But I'll end it there so we have time for questions. We have almost 5 minutes. Yes?
Anecdotally, I heard that one of the reasons there weren't instrumental music in the South was because during the war, the Union armies, when they went through and burned down the various cities, the churches lost all their instrumental music, including the organs. Did you find any evidence of that in your research?
I haven't seen it. I mean, most of the... You had a few churches that had a very, very simple form of an organ before the Civil War. But that was unusual, in my experience anyway. I could be wrong about that. Many more of them, I feel like, they came in the 1880s and 90s. That was the church could afford it. It was a major expenditure for a church. And so for a lot of churches, it wasn't something on their radar screen. But in a way, what kind of started happening is, you know, a lot of people liked it. Like they felt it. It's almost, I don't know, I'm trying to think of something analogous today. For a lot of people, it made for a better worship service for them. And, you know, others not. So, what's that?
Choose your poison.
Yeah. So for a lot of churches, if they didn't have an organ, a lot of people are like, oh, I don't really want to, you know, I'm not interested in going to my church. You know, it didn't appeal to them for that reason. So that's one factor.
Is Annie Tuttle's biography in the bookstore?
There's only a handful of copies really around. I mean, there's some, but Pepperdine's library has one. And then I say Terry Gardner was here. He gave me a copy, which I was like, wow, that was very kind of him. It's called Another World Wonder. Every once in a while, you can find one for sale. If you kind of, you know, Amazon or Google it. Another World Wonder. And a few libraries do have it, though. Like a lot of university libraries, if you look around, you might be able to. Or maybe. Yeah. It's pretty rare, but not crazy rare. Yes, his biography of her. Yeah, Edward Robinson's biography.
And who is that?
He's a historian at Southwest Christian College. He's a historian of African American Churches of Christ. Okay. And a good one. So he provides really great context. Some of my looking at her, I borrowed from him.
What was his last name?
Robinson. Yeah, Edward Robinson. And he's written also on the history of African American Jesus Christ in Texas. I feel like I'm going to email him and say, Yeah, he's written something like that. Yeah. I didn't think he looks a little bit later than the era of picking up, but that was another figure. All right, other questions?
Have you recorded this session?
Yes.
So it'll be downloaded?
Yes.
Okay, but no, we can download it.
Yeah.
Is your PowerPoint edited?
It can be. If you want to email me, that is fine. Well, see me after. I'll give you my email address. I'd be happy to send it to you. Oh, yes, yes. There's much more information about that. That's one of the reasons I told this part about the Churches of Christ, because there's a bit written on Northern women, but practically nothing on Southern women. Yeah, these are some exceptions. I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg, by the way. I just chose a little slice to share with you. The stories are endless. I mean, you have women challenging David Lipscomb in the pages of the Gospel Advocate on his interpretation of women's roles. Selena Holman, you may have heard of her, that's one common one. But there's endless stories. When you really dig deep, it doesn't look like what you think. And I think it's just because we don't know. That's why I'm writing this book. I want people to know. If you know it, then you see things very differently, which I didn't say this in the presentation, which I think can inform our current debates, because we have this idea that women never had a say, they didn't do anything, but that's just really not true. It just wasn't formalized. So sometimes we're only debating about names and titles rather than actual roles that women play. Yes?
So would the Northern geographical areas that they were talking, you know, the, just, you know, the, would that be Chicago? Would that be Ohio?
Yes, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois. Indiana. By the Midwest is your Midwest. Most common place. And then to a certain extent, you know, California too.
But not east, like Maryland.
A little bit in Maryland. I don't know where the geographic distribution stops. I know that when you get into the Northeast, like New England, it gets pretty sparse for the Stone Temple movement. Mm-hmm. Then and today. The movement has spread out a little, but not incredibly so. Yeah. So, yeah, when I say Northern, I could say Midwest, because that's most of it. Anyone else? Yes?
Not really a question, but a comment. You know, this doesn't really seem like a new idea. 1800s, I've been reading some ancient documents that mentioned a woman's group much earlier than this, not in the United States, abroad, that supported a local evangelist. His name was Jesus of Nazareth.
Yes.
I don't know whether they called them ladies' sewing circle or quilting organization, but they did fund his ministry. So there might be some precedent, for this kind of thing. I don't know, but...
So I say you have to know the historical context for why there was such a rejection of these organizations and what women were doing.
Was it a cultural thing? Was it a patriarchal
resistance? Well, I still don't call it patriarchal. Like I said, what the American Christian Missionary Society, you know, condemns slavery, condemns the Confederacy. I mean, if you're a Southerner, that was very isolating.
Okay.
And anger-inducing. And so you have a real rift at that point. Even some Southerners who had supported missionary studies before that kind of back away. They just couldn't. You were seen almost like a traitor to your section, if you do that. So that's like the culture does matter. But I don't want to reduce it just to that. I mean, I think they genuinely also felt like this is going to corrupt our churches. Because, you know, you could look at some of these Northern churches, and they were spending like hundreds of thousands of dollars building them. Southern churches are going, it's not really how you should spend. Because should you really have that elaborate of a church? Or should it be simpler? But it's all complicated, right? So I don't want to say it was just cultural. They had some theological and other concerns. But because you have Northern Church of Christ that, feel the same. Yeah.
See, in Canada, that was all about opposition to man-made institutions.
Yeah.
And so that was what it was about. And what you mentioned with the festivals as being Northern in Canada, it was that same thing, too. The denominations do that, so we won't do that.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was opposition to what other people are doing.
institution.
Yeah, it's kind of, that's how they self-identify.
Yeah.
You know, it's, this is we're not going to do those things. Those are about, otherwise you just go join a denomination.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you know, I think they felt like that's part of what separated them from others. You know, they had this simple church that really focused on evangelizing and not on all these other things that could be distracting or corrupting or, you know. At least that's one element. I mean, I think there's one other
one. I'd rather be bombarded by people that come up there and want to individually get their email address. You want to just give it to them?
Oh, sure. I just didn't want to interrupt our... well, I think we better stop there because I know we're kind of over time now. But I'll write it on the board for you here as soon as I find something. Thanks for coming.
Okay.